journalist conference, and a lot of us know his work. I've been reading Tim's work, I think, probably since Tim was in graduate school, is my guess, and before I was in graduate school. When The Economist I was working for at the time came back from a conference with a paper of Tim's. It was really one of the first empirical studies of business-state relations that we had in post-communist countries, and one of the first systematic attempts to try to understand the relationship between businesses and bureaucrats. And so Tim's work much of it has been very much in that spirit of careful. So it's all been careful, and much of it has a state relations.
Some more careful than others.
Much of what we know about business-state relations in post-communist countries, we know from Tim's work. So it's a delight to have him here with us today to talk to us about property rights and property wrongs in Russia. So Tim, thanks.
Great. Thanks a lot. That was very generous. You'll soon find overly generous introduction. I just want to thank everybody for coming and thank Krika and the Political Economy Group for inviting me and for making the trip very easy so far. I'll start off with the good news, which is as often the case is also the bad news. The data that I'm presenting are very new. They're from a survey that I conducted in October 2006. So that's the good news, that it's, exciting new data. The bad news is that it's not, as perfectly ironed out as I hope it will be in a few more months. The other thing is, if people have questions along the way, please feel free to stop me. Since this is work in progress, I'd really be interested in your feedback, and that will probably be easier to get if you jump in at any time. Okay? So the title of the talk is Property Rights and Property Wrongs. And you'll notice a biblical theme throughout some of it as well. So the research question here is, are property rights obtained through legally dubious means forever tainted with original sin? Or can right holders make their ill-gotten gains legitimate by doing good works? Right? Now, I think this is a critical question for countries where privatization is conducted in a very opaque and often corrupt manner. So it's an important question for transition countries, and you can think of Russia, and I don't need to go into the details on the Yukos case and some of the other recent attempts to reverse privatization. But it's also, if we think more broadly about Latin America, we can look at the steps by Hugo Chavez in Venezuela to nationalize some of the energy sector companies and some of the public utilities, Evo Morales in Bolivia trying to nationalize the gas sector, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, retaking private lands to redistribute to political supporters. So I think this kind of problem of renationalization or reprivatization or state trying to alter privatization once it's been conducted is a pretty general problem. And more generally, if we think, the market for insurance against renationalization risks is something that we've had for a long time, and, people seem to make a good living selling this product. So it seems that at least people are concerned about this problem in a lot of countries other than Russia. So it's probably, the rest of the talk will be about Russia. So that was my fillip to and why I think this is actually a very broad question. Now, what are the consequences of these attempts to alter privatization once it's been conducted? Well, when privatization is often opaque and widely seen as illegitimate, right holders may fear that their rights are politically vulnerable, particularly to attempts by more populistly oriented leaders to rally the public against the thievery of the nation's jewels and riches, and to have those assets taken away from them once they've gotten them through privatization. Now, of course, the right holders are smart, and if they anticipate that the state is likely to redraw the privatization contract, then they're going to have a lot of incentives to strip those assets while they have them, because they fear that in the future they might be taken away. So I think what this suggests is that it's important to think not only about how right holders feel about their property rights, and a lot of the work that Kathy's done and that I've done, we ask right holders about different kinds of constraints they face and how secure their property rights are. But this is a little bit different. What I'm doing here, I'm asking kind of non-right holders their views about privatization, as this seems to be an important a political resource for a populist leader to rally against people who've benefited from a corrupt privatization. Okay. Now, let me start off with a couple of quotes. The first comes from Boris Nikolaevich Yeltsin, October 1991, right before they're introducing the shock therapy economic reform program. He says, "The task that I've set before the government is to make the reforms irreversible." Notice he doesn't say to make them efficient, but he wants to make them irreversible. That's a preeminent concern in Russian, given the highly polarized political setting between Yeltsin and the Communist Party. Fast forward to July 2000, shortly after President Putin takes office. He has a meeting with Russian businessmen where it's leaked to the press that he's told the Russian businessman he does not want a reversal of privatization, right? He says, stay out of politics and you can kind of keep your assets, right? September 26, 2003, again, here's a headline from Interfax, "Putin against reversal of privatization." A couple months later, Putin declares, "I'm a categorical opponent of a review of the results of privatization." April, 2 years later, "Any allegations that Russia is preparing to revise the privatization results are groundless." Finally, he gets even more specific. "We have quite a number of large, purely privately owned oil and gas companies. Nobody is going to nationalize them." Now, what are the inferences we should draw from this, from these repeated attempts to reassure you about how I'm not going to take your property rights away? This is kind of like the, when you go into the restroom in a restaurant and it says your employees must wash hands before returning to work. You know, if you have to come out and say it, it really doesn't make me feel all that secure. So let me talk briefly about what I mean by property rights, just so that we're all on the same page. And this is very standard treatment. We often think of property rights as a bundle of rights, including the power to use, transfer, and obtain income from land, labor, and capital. It's widely held that privately held and secure property rights are often seen to be critical to the economic development. North and Thomas argue that it's the keys to the rise of the Western world is in secure property rights. And this is the justification for why we see privatization in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the post-communist world. Now, typically, post-privatization property rights are often treated as unproblematic. And by that, I mean, often we spend a lot of time talking about privatization and less time talking about, what happens to those rights after they're privatized. And again, let me make a biblical reference here. What the state giveth, the state also taketh away, right? And the threat of reversal of privatization, where the state takes back a privatization, might be higher where those property rights are not broadly accepted and legitimate. I have a very kind of minimalist treatment of legitimate that I'll talk a little about later. And since right holders may anticipate this reversal and strip assets, this is really a big problem. And I think it's also an important source of Putin's leverage in Russia. Putin knows that if he attacks the oligarchs on privatization issues, the public is not going to run out onto the main street in Moscow in defense of the oligarchs to protect private property. If anything, they're going to run out to urge him on to string these guys up from the lamppost. Right. So this has given Putin a lot of leverage over the oligarchs. So more specifically, the questions that I'm going to ask are whether the manner of privatization, specifically the severity of violations of the law in privatization, whether they influence subsequent views about the legitimacy of property rights. And then, do the actions of right holders influence the subsequent legitimacy of property? And then, if so, what kinds of actions are important? And again, this is not the view of the right holder, it's more the view of the mass public that I'm interested in, because we're talking about legitimacy more broadly. So, in thinking about property rights in this way, we can surmise that this perceived legitimacy within society influences property rights, and not just the institutional constraints that we've all spent a lot of time talking about. And again, this recognizes, I think, better than it's often done, is that property rights are politically contingent and not simply given or protected by law. Now, I think this notion also introduces some possibility of agency into the literature. If we think that right holders can take steps to make their rights more legitimate by using the asset well or by providing public goods for the region, this introduces some agency into the literature in which is typically absent, because typically we think of right holders as constrained by institutions or resources or whatever, and don't think they have a whole lot of ability to change the legitimacy and ultimately the security of their property rights. Okay. Now I'm going to develop a couple of arguments about what might influence the legitimacy of property rights among the mass public. And again, if there are any questions, please feel free to jump in. Okay. Now, first, it might be the case that the manner in which property is acquired influences property rights. Right? We might think that if the mass public thinks that you stole an asset, that they would view that that taking as illegitimate. Seems fairly straightforward. But there's also counter arguments for why this more generally might not be the case, and for why specifically in Russia this might not be the case, right? If we think back to Coase, and a lot of the privatizers in Russia at the time were thinking a lot about Coase, their view was it doesn't really matter how rights get from the state into private hands. We just want to get them out of private hands as quickly as possible. We won't infringe on right holders' ability to trade those property rights. And eventually, they'll find an equilibrium where everybody's happy and the property rights will be stable. And we rarely get quotes that are kind of direct inferences from abstract academic theories, but I don't think we get much better than this one here. This is Anatoly Chubais channeling Coase, basically. He says, look, the factory managers steal and steal and steal. They are stealing absolutely everything, and it is impossible to stop them. But let them steal and take their property. They will then become owners and decent administrators of this property. Right? So this would lead us to expect that it really doesn't matter that much how property rights get transferred from state to private hands. Moreover, you know, there's many people argue that the formal law in Russia doesn't really matter all that much. Right? So the law on the books, you know, so they violated the law on privatization. Well, you know. All the privatizations, you know, had some legal problems with them. You could rationalize for why a lot of people might think that it's not all that important. Putin has a great quote on this, where he was addressing the big business union, where he says, you know, a lot of people think that all privatizations were done with violations. That's rubbish. He says, well, you know, what if 5 or 6 or 7 privatizations were done with violations? That doesn't mean that all privatizations were done with violations, right? So this immediately began this guessing game about who was next after Hodorkovsky and who was these 5 or 6, 7 people that he was talking about. So we might think that the severity of the illegality during privatization might be associated with then how people perceive the legitimacy of property rights. Okay. Yeah.
A quick clarification. So when you're talking about the manner in which property is acquired and you're associating that with illegality, sort of legality versus illegality, then you're not talking about different forms of privatization.
No, exactly
such as
right.
Voucher.
No, it's not voucher sales.
Okay.
It's not
okay.
Anything like that. It's just
so
yeah.
This sentence is not a very good. So it's really illegality versus.
Yeah, you'll see from what's coming up later that it's really about illegality and it doesn't really have anything to do with
the form of process that's been adopted
sale.
In Russia compared to
no,
other.
No. Okay, so this is the kind of original sin argument. Okay, now there's a debate right now about the economic consequences of altering privatization. Hoff and Stiglitz have a paper where they generate a formal model to show that privatizations that are not broadly accepted by the public generate very few efficiency gains. And not on the basis of this, but other people in Russia have made the case that, look, we need to redraw the this contract that was written during the 90s between big business and the state, and there might be some advantages to reprivatizing. And some people point to the Kryvyi Rih of a steel plant in Ukraine, which was privatized to the brother-in-law of the president for a very low price, and then was reprivatized for a price that was about five times higher after the Orange Revolution. So people point to this as a kind of successful example where privatization might make some economic sense. Other people point to the Yukos example, and people have made the claim that this then sparked a capital flight, which is probably not a good thing. And others have pointed out that during the time when the Kryvyi Rih steel plant was being reprivatized, this sparked a lot of panic among factory owners in Ukraine, who then took a lot of their capital outside the country, and this caused a lot of decline in economic growth after they'd been growing for quite some time. Okay. Let's turn now to take the attention off the privatization process and look at the actions of the right holders themselves. There's two versions of the good works argument. This is the 1.0 version. And here, the good use of an asset increases the legitimacy and ultimately the security of property rights. And this is an argument that business people in Russia, for a lot of reasons, really like. Okay, so I stole the asset, but look at me now. I'm using it well. I'm providing jobs. I'm doing all these good things. And this is just a simpler notion of a sweat equity argument, right? And that, you know, I'm using the asset well, and I should be rewarded for that. Okay. The other version of the good works argument, good works 2.0, is more about public goods provision. And this argues that the provision of public goods can increase the legitimacy of property rights. And for those of you who've been following Russia, you know, the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a lot of talk about corporate social responsibility, being a real buzzword for the Putin administration and for the large industrial lobbies as well. Firms are prominently promoting their good works, sometimes even voluntarily, right? Sometimes even without pressure from state officials to provide these kinds of goods. But it's a very kind of very much a growing movement, and also it's you know, the data are difficult to surmise, but what comparative data does exist suggests that public goods provision by firms in Russia is much higher than it is in developed capitalist economies. And in part, this is a holdover from the Soviet period when firms often provided public goods for their regions. Okay, so this notion is that, okay, maybe I stole the asset, but now look, I'm using the asset to provide general benefits for the region. We'll see whether or not people buy this argument. I'll turn to the data very quickly. This is done by the Levada Center in October 2006, and it's piggybacking questions on their monthly national survey. And for graduate students who are looking to do research relatively inexpensively, this is a good way to go about doing it. They're face-to-face interviews in Russian in the home of the respondent. The response rate was about 57%, and they call back about 20% of the respondents to make sure that the interviews are actually conducted. And that they've been doing this survey for about 14 years or so. So it's pretty well known, and I'm sure a lot of you who follow the region know, have seen some of the surveys that they do. Okay. Just to start off, we asked some questions about privatization. And this, in some sense, was a question that tried to, you know, defang people's perceptions of privatization right off the bat. So we didn't get this, you know, kind of knee-jerk, you know, hang the bastards from the lamppost kind of reaction about privatization. So we asked, for all its fault, the privatization of large industrial enterprises in Russia in the 1990s was necessary. Agree, strongly agree, more or less agree, strongly disagree, or don't know. We have here about a third of the respondents agree, more or less agree, or strongly agree. But more than half of the respondents more or less disagree or strongly disagree. About 15% don't know. Make of that what you will. And we asked this question, somewhere along the line. We said, the privatization of large industrial enterprises in Russia in the 1990s was often conducted with major violations of the law on privatization. And here we have about 75% of respondents think that, more or less agree with this statement. So there's very broad perception that privatization was problematic from a legal point of view. I like the 10% that more or less disagree or strongly disagree. Those are the managers, probably.
This was an extraordinarily complicated law, right?
Right.
And you and I probably would have trouble figuring out whether somebody violated. This is just, aren't you really having the illegality there as a proxy for legitimacy?
I'll get to that in a minute. But here, I'm just asking, from their perspective, not, have they done extensive research on this, but from their perception about privatization.
What are you learning from that?
I'm just asking this because I want to get, I'm not going to do any analysis of this question. All I just want to know is what's the distribution of people in the population that think that there were major violations of the law on privatization. So I'm going to draw a distinction between major and minor violations. That's how I'm going to tap into the severity of the illegality on privatization, right? So this is just an attempt to get the distribution of how many people think the privatization in Russia was conducted with major illegalities. Okay?
I guess I'm just puzzled as to how these people would have any idea of knowing whether it's illegal or not. What's their knowledge base on that?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot written about privatization. I'm not asking whether this is factually correct.
Right.
They could have it could be way off. It could be that actually it could be that every privatization was done, by the law. I'm not asking them to make as experts, but just as witnesses or something like that. Okay, that's thanks for helping me clarify that though. One of the things that I'll get to in a minute is it might be the people's perceptions of privatization are really driven by underlying perceptions about illegality, about inequality, right? So it might be that they link the inequality in Russia to privatization, and that's why they don't like privatization. So we asked a kind of general question about people's perceptions about inequality generally in the world, and whether or not this is something that's inescapable and justified because people have different levels of ability and commitment or not. And I was kind of glad to see that the distribution here is not it's not all down here, right? It seems to be fairly evenly spaced. So it just suggests that people have different views about acceptability of inequality. Okay. And it also might be the case that people don't like privatization because they just think that state-owned firms are more efficient, right? Более эффективно, that's the Russian word we use. It's striking that there's the efficiency is not a concept that's easily translated into the Russian language. So here, I thought this was kind of interesting, actually, just the raw numbers. About half the respondents thought that, agreed with the statement that state-owned companies were more effective than privately-owned companies.
That's sort of the best empirical evidence. In fact, that is probably the case in Russia.
It would be nice to split it down by sector, but this is just tapping.
We're privatized today, right? So.
Right. Oh yeah, actually that would have been better, right? I can check whether it's privatized or just private in this question.
What companies are still state-owned?
Well, what's today? Some are that were private owned are becoming state-owned, but oil and gas sector.
Right.
Some pharmacies, so there are some small businesses that are still state-owned. There are also the public utilities are also largely state-owned. So, but I'm not trying to get at, this is just a kind of general question about people's just perceptions about, the state of property. Because it might be that people don't like privatization because they think state property is better, right? And it seems that, that's, a lot of people think that way. To try to get at these three different arguments about the legitimacy of privatization, We set up an experimental question where we created 8 different versions of a question, and we made small changes in the question to try to figure out whether these small changes in the question changed the responses in the aggregate about the hypothetical question that we proposed. So what we're going to do is manipulate the type of good works and the severity of the violations of the law, and we'll see if the differences in the responses to these 8 different questions vary a lot or a little. And this is a nice way to get estimates of the size of the effects, because basically the demands on the data are much less stringent than if you're having to do a regression and decide about what variables go in, what variables go out. Right? So we should be able to attribute differences in the responses just to these small changes in the question. Okay. So can people see this in the back? I've got one yes and one no. Okay. This is the question that we asked. And there are 8 questions embedded in this. One group of people got this question. Let's say that an industrial firm was privatized in the mid-1990s. After privatization, managers of the firm invested little of their own capital in the modernization and restructuring of their firm. And they have provided no social programs for the development of the region. Now, it turns out the firm was privatized with major violations of the law on privatization. Do you believe that this matter should be turned over to the arbitration court? Yes, more or less yes, more or less no, no. Then if the respondent said yes, I do think the state arbitration court should review this matter. What steps should the judge take? Should this firm be returned to state ownership? Should it be privatized to new owners? Should the guilty pay a significant fine? Should the guilty pay a small fine? Or, since so much time has passed, nothing should be done about it? Right. So, what we're going to do is we're just going to vary these questions in bold, whether or not the manager of the firm invested a little or a great deal of their own capital in the modernization and structure of the firm, whether or not they provided no or many social programs for the development of the region. And here the previous question asked them about to draw a distinction between social programs that they provide for their workers and social programs that they provide for the region, because that's what we're really interested in. And then we're going to vary whether or not the privatization of the law were major or minor. Now, somebody asked me why there were no violations of the law on privatization. And I had brought this up to the pollster in Russia, and she said, come on, you know, she said, basically, you know, you want to have a hypothetical question that people believe, you know, is actually relevant, and, you know, to say that, you know, the other problem is that, you know, it would be nice to have much finer distinctions in all these cases, you know. No, but here, you know, due to the experimental setup, you're really limited in the degrees of freedom that you have to ask these kinds of blunt questions. Yeah.
I like the experimental setup. It's really clever. But the consequence, do you believe, should be turned over to the courts? Isn't that also picking up attitudes toward the effectiveness or validity of the courts?
Yeah.
Let's say, no, it shouldn't be turned over to the courts. It should be stronger from a higher level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the drawbacks to this version. In an earlier version, where I did the same experiment with managers, and there we also asked a battery of questions about courts. And we could control for that. Here, we didn't have a whole lot of questions about court, so that's a a valid point.
If they answered no, they never saw the options, the court, the instruments.
That's true. It could be that. That's fine. So people think the courts are really bad. It might be that, you know, they don't want them to do anything to them. That might be one.
Right, or it could be that they think it's illegitimate, but that they don't necessarily think that turning them over to the courts
is a good idea.
Yeah. Good, so.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point.
So is there any way to know what people thought of as being a major or minor violation?
No. We didn't. We thought about putting a valuation on it, but that gets very tricky, particularly in Moscow versus the regions, the numbers are going to mean different things. And
I was actually thinking more of the substantive nature of what kind of violation
yeah.
there was.
Yeah.
And I think you're, you know.
I mean, the other thing that we could have done is said, look, the managers sold, they stole the asset, but then
right.
they sold it. What should happen to the new owners? That was something that we thought a lot about, but it just got a little complicated. But this is the main question. So let me read it one more time. So a firm was privatized in the mid-1990s after privatization. The managers of the firm invested a little or a great deal of their own capital in the modernization and restructuring of the firm. They provided no or many social programs for the development of the region. It turns out the firm is privatized with minor or major violations of the law on privatization. Mm-hmm. And then the responses.
Okay.
So here are the responses. This is the condition where the violations were seen as major. And a yes answer means that the court should review the matter. We'll get into what they should do in a minute. So let's start off with the worst case scenario here. You have a very bad corporate citizen, not providing any public goods for the region, and they're not using the asset well. And the asset was privatized with major violations, right? Worst case scenario. So here, 83% of the respondents said yes, or they said yes, or more or less yes, that the state, the arbitration court should review this matter. Now, if we move here, these are situations in which the managers have used the asset well. They've invested in the modernizing and restructuring of their firm, but they haven't provided any public goods for the region. And again, the violations of the law on privatization were major.
How do you define public goods?
We had a whole list of eight different things that people, that firms have provided, such as charity, help to hospitals, help to for orphanages, sponsoring cultural events, help for unemployment, building houses that's often firms are provide resources directly for that, not directly for taxes. Yeah.
So is it possible that the question sort of primes them to think about all the good things that public goods provide, but they don't necessarily make the connection between investment and higher wages and job growth?
Was the good news prompted and clarified as well? Or is that left more to their
Well, we define good use as having invested in the modernization and restructuring of the firm. That's the good use.
No connection to the personal level, though, the higher wages or
no,
better working conditions?
No,
or,
no. I mean, one thing that we could have done was say that that they've used the asset well and they're providing a lot of jobs.
Right.
That would have been another kind of. I mean, the tricky thing, these experiments are really nice, but they're like lasers, right? You know, you can get a good read on a very narrow question, but if you want to go a little bit to the right or to the left, you know, you've got to make these stark choices, and there are lots of interesting things that you could do with them. But the punchline here is that using the asset well, in investing in the modernizing and restructuring of the firm, basically buys you nothing, right? Here, we have a situation in which the managers have provided public goods for the region, but they haven't used the asset well. And here we see a significant jump between these two. Here, it goes down by about 11%, just based solely on the provision of public goods. So that's kind of good evidence for the public goods argument. And here, we see a substantial decline for business people who are really good corporate citizens. Right? It goes all the way down to 65%. One way to interpret this is, basically, two-thirds of the respondents, don't want any part of this. Basically, they think, I don't know, Warren Buffett could come down or Bill Gates could take over a factory,
yeah.
And they don't care. They're not going to make it legitimate.
Okay,
so
Tim, just clarify.
Right.
I'm going, N equals 1,000.
Oh, no, no, yeah, 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 sorry, 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 I'm sorry, thank you very much. We have 8 versions of the question, and we divide them into groups of 200 apiece, and we randomly assign who gets what version of the question. I thought I had that. I must have skipped over that slide, but yeah, that's the...
No, you got that. I was just thinking 1,600 people, how do we have a greater
N? Right. The non-response rate was 1,400. No, it's nothing like that. The trick that we do is you change the version of the question, and you randomly assign who gets what version of the question. And in theory, you know, given the law of large numbers, that should control for every other fact, all the other factors that are going on. So that the differences should only be due to these small changes in the wording, right? That's the setup here. Okay. So here we see that I think 2 points. One is that providing public goods can help make assets more perceived to be more legitimate, but you know, doing them both together gives you more bang for the buck. Now with minor violations, we see again fairly high numbers. Here's the worst case scenario, no good use, no public goods provided. The sweat equity argument of using the asset well buys you nothing. Here, the public goods argument also buys you nothing. But again, we see that doing both together does give you a significant increase in the degree of legitimacy. So from these two, with the exception that this doesn't change anything with minor violations, and there is some kind of general pattern across these two experiments.
The surprising thing I think there is that there's no difference between the minor and major. They're both 63%, right? That's unbelievable.
There you go. That's the this is the next slide, which collapses those two. These numbers should look familiar. The dark numbers here are minor violations. This is the one we just saw. And then here are the ones with the major violations. Right? So one way to think about this is when public goods are provided, the original sin argument makes no difference at all. Here, when there's no public goods provided, we do see a 10-point increase. 13-point increase. So there is, it's not completely refuted, it's kind of that, it's sort of mixed for these two arguments. And it might be because people think that it's not surprising that privatization was done with lots of illegalities at the time. There was a question?
Yeah. I was just thinking how interesting it would be to repeat this experiment in 5 years to see whether minor violation and major violation numbers would depreciate at the same rate or a difference. Maybe.
So that's right down in my date book. Write grant to NSF in 4 years. One thing that I kind of am more comfortable with the changes between the the comparisons rather than the levels. The levels we have 200 respondents in each category, and I would have thought about the experiment differently if I was really only out there trying to capture the levels. I was really more interested in the change. I'm not going to go to the mat on the actual levels, but I do think that the changes, I think those are, I think I have more confidence in those. Okay? So here again, we see mixed evidence for this original sin argument. Okay, now, apologies again to the people in the back, but this is the responses where... including both people who said no, it shouldn't be reviewed, and people who said yes, and then what their various options were for what the judge should do with this violation. So with major violations, the one thing that struck me, and again, I don't want to make too much out of the levels, but the support for renationalization here was lower than I expected. This is a raw number. About a third of the respondents. Here it's about a quarter of the respondents. My intuition was it would, I don't know, maybe people, you know, we have many of experts in the room, like, could have gotten a tally about whether they thought that would have been higher. I thought it would.
Just anticipating to be stolen again.
Well, we do have, you know, reprivatization is an option here. But no, actually, this said renationalization, it will be kept in state hands. So it might, if you think that, you know, the state can steal from itself, which is a very real possibility, you know, then that's absolutely true. The other, then, about 20% of the respondents in all the cases said to be privatized. Somewhere in the high teens said they should pay a big fine. Somewhere in the, you know, around 5% said small fine, you know, small minority, less than 5% said do nothing, and this is the number do not review. And then the number down here is just the do nothing or do not review category. So this is just the people who said no, that the arbitration court shouldn't review this matter, or the people who said, well, they should review it, but they shouldn't do anything. And again, we see, you know, similar kind of pattern where the good use doesn't buy you anything. You see a bigger jump here where the public goods, you know, buys you something, and doing both together gives you a bigger jump in terms of your, in terms of the legitimacy of the property rights. This is with major violations. And then with minor violations, we see that this is the best case scenario, right? Minor violations of the law on privatization, public goods provided, and investments, and still, you know, even including the do nothings and the do not reviews, we get all the way up to 43%. But again, we shouldn't make too much out of levels, but I think it is interesting. And again, we see, you know, a similar pattern. I haven't been able to figure out whether there's any pattern within these various choices, but I don't have any theory for why some people might favor reprivatization more than renationalization.
This may be a lawyer question, but the only one that the court actually has the power to do is to do nothing on your list.
Yeah.
The court doesn't have the power to do any of those other things.
Yeah.
So it's an experimental question, right?
Yeah,
In a perfect world, what would you have the court do?
Yeah, I mean, right? These kinds of experimental hypothetical questions, the phrase, in a perfect world, is very apt.
Yeah.
I mean, the other
problematic in Russia to have courts in a perfect world in the same sentence.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing was to introduce the procuracy into the question,
but
and
they
that
really, yeah.
Yeah, that might have just list, you know yeah. driven. Yeah, I thought the courts in some ways are a little, you know.
I think they're a little more procuracy. Yeah.
But it's a little bit more neutral.
And you could have also bypassed the institution and gone directly to outcomes.
I'll see if there's some, and I'd repeat the survey with managers, and there we, you know, I think I might be able to get at this, you know, a little bit better. When I did it with managers, we got the similar kind of pattern. The levels were lower, not surprisingly, but the changes were pretty similar. And there I can't do what I think, you know, is to try to take into account people's perceptions of, you know, the courts or the capacity of the state as well. I probably could have just said, you know, what do you think should have happened? Okay.
So I guess, I mean, I'm very surprised that the numbers are that low for nationalization and reprivatization. Mm-hmm. And so in polling, people have consistently, sort of 60-70% of those polled have consistently favored renationalization.
Yeah.
And so I guess there are a couple of inferences one can draw. So one is that in those polls, people aren't being given other options.
Right.
And so if you also include the possibility of fines, they're not necessarily going to choose renationalization. The other is that in the polling, they're just thinking about the big oil companies.
Yeah.
And here you're not asking about the big oil companies.
Right.
You're asking about an industrial firm.
Right. I mean, they often will say, you know, the question's on is, you know, should privatization be revisited, right, or revised?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, you know, doesn't get you. I do think that, you know, once you prompt people to think a little bit about, okay, well, you know, what might the options be, you might get less of hang these guys from the lamppost kind of response. And also, the debate about, it's one thing to debate about oil companies and whether the state should own them or not. I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, the more important question, if the manufacturing firms feel like they're threatened as well, that's a much worse scenario. Or if you talk with business people and they'll say, well, yeah, as long as you're not in dealing with strategic sectors, we think our rights will be protected. But, we don't, know how well, what the repercussion, the knockoff effects are nationalizing oil and gas, what other people also think. So a couple of caveats. One, that these are, again, just a snapshot. So you need to take that into account. I'm also not really measuring behavior here, right? We're just asking people about their perceptions, about, what is legitimate. And remember, legitimacy here, I'm only saying that for somebody to say that the property right is legitimate is a very passive response. All they have to do is say that the court shouldn't review it, which is a very minimalist notion of legitimacy. Also, it'd be interesting to see how well these results travel to other parts of the world. Now, one thing is that we might also think that the privatization outcomes are reflections of inequality or attitudes towards private property more generally. So, as a first cut, the dependent variable here is people's response to the question about whether or not the state arbitration court should review this matter, this 1-4 scale. And controlling for the different conditions, we had a number of questions on earnings. Now, getting good data on earnings in Russia is a challenge. This is, they asked three questions on their survey. One is to put your household income into a range. They also have a subjective measure which says, do you have enough food? Do you have enough money to buy food? Do you have enough money to buy food and clothing? Do you have enough money to buy food, clothing, and shelter? Do you have money to buy food, clothing, shelter, and disposable goods? So the one thing we see from this is there doesn't seem to be a relationship between people's earnings and their perceptions about the legitimacy of property rights. But I want to draw a big question mark around that just because it's difficult to get good data on earnings. But
so high responses more strongly agree that it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little tricky. Education doesn't seem to have much of a, seems to be close in a couple of these, but not off the front. Older people are more likely to favor revisiting the privatization. People in regions that are more wealthy are actually, this is recoded. You're right. It's actually
Excuse
flipped
me,
around.
What's the columns there? What's the first column, second column?
These are ordered probability regressions on the answer to the question: do you think privatization should be? Do you think that this privatization should be reviewed by the state arbitration courts? Right. So we have three different models, and we're controlling for some basic kind of demographic and geographic factors. And here's the two things that I'm interested in: whether or not that these we do see that there is some relationship between whether or not people think state property is more effective than private property, and we don't seem to see a relationship between people's perceptions about inequality generally and whether or not the privatization should be reviewed. That's the controlling for the conditions and controlling for these demographic factors. We do see that there is some relationship between people's belief about the effectiveness of state property and private property, but we don't seem to have an effect about inequality as a norm. So this is just a way to test some other kinds of explanations that people have put forward to see whether or not they're also influencing people's perceptions about legitimacy. Yeah.
Could you just clarify maybe a little bit on the magnitude of these coefficients?
Yeah, I haven't worked out what the magnitude of the coefficients are. These are just
or just maybe the literal interpretation here. I mean, so 0.097. So what did you have? What was the question? Four different. One through four.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
one. One through four for state property. Yeah.
All right. So if I move up one from one to two on that, then the probability of me wanting the courts to review privatization goes up by one percentage point. Is it?
Well, since it's order of probate, you can't just read it off straight like that.
Okay.
So I just haven't done it yet. This was. I was debating whether or not to include this or not. This is kind of icing on the cake that maybe it's not quite ready. But basically, the punchline is that but there does seem to be some relationship to people's attitudes about property and legitimacy of privatization. Okay, controlling for these other factors. Okay, I have some related work where I repeated this survey with company managers in January and February 2005. And again, we found similar responses to the manipulations, but managers were less willing to review privatization. One thing that was interesting is we also found that firms that provide public goods invested at higher rates than other firms. Now, this is consistent with the story that people are providing public goods in order to buy some goodwill from the public in order to make their assets more legitimate. And the tricky thing is they also might be providing public goods because the governor is forcing them to provide public goods. And they're also investing, and the governor is targeting those firms that have money, and they're also investing because they have money, right? So I tried to control for that by including some questions about bribery of governor and relations with the governor. But again, this is a pretty easy test. But we do see that there is some link to firms' behavior where that is consistent with the argument that providing public goods in order to make their assets more secure. So this gets beyond legitimacy and questions about attitudes to behavior. Okay. So what are the punchline here? Well, we see that privatized property rights in Russia are still problematic. I think that's fair to say. The original Sin argument seems to produce mixed results. And it might be that that these high levels of people's willingness to punish even minor violations of the law, if you take a literal notion, yes, of course, they should be punished. I'm not quite sure that's how you should read it, but that's one possible interpretation of that. Also, these high levels could also be this notion that these guys should be punished because they stole. We do see some evidence that public goods can increase legitimacy on its own, but we see stronger evidence that public goods can help increase legitimacy when these two things are done in common. So it seems to take a fair amount to convince people that you should hold on to the asset, particularly if it's seen that you privatize the asset illegally. Now we also see in both experiments that the good use of an asset on its own has little real effect on the legitimacy of privatization. Okay. Just some implications. First, I think this suggests that it's important to think about the legitimacy of property rights in the broader community and not just to look at right holders themselves, which is what people, myself included, commonly do. Also, to remember that property rights are not static, that they are politically contingent, and that right holders can take some steps to make property rights more legitimate. So there is some agency, some steps that right holders can take to try to make their assets more legitimate. And I think this also might help shed some light on this privatization paradox that people, particularly in Latin America, talk about, where privatization increases the number of telephones per capita and increases the cleanliness of the water, people still hate privatization. You know, even where they like trade liberalization, they hate privatization, right? So it might be that, you know, corrupt privatizations in Latin America are not unknown, and it might be that this is what people are thinking about when they're asked to ask questions about privatization, even where objectively, you know, one might think that they would like it more. Okay, so I think that's about it.
So, how do your analytical results shed some light on this privatization?
Well, it might be that people don't like privatization in Latin America because they see that the privatization process itself was corrupt. So even when they're there, you know, even when
your
they're
results show that the big thing is the public goods and good use. I mean, that's the big distinction here, right? Because we don't want to make too much of a
right.
level. So if
right.
I have to say what the punch is,
right?
Sort of.
Yeah, I take this from the kind of mixed results for the original sin argument, right? Where in half the cases we do see some, you know, significant difference in people's perceptions about the legitimacy of privatization, depending on whether the violations of the law were major or minor.
Okay.
So that's where I'm taking this from.
You raised a question about this kind of work, how well it might travel. I'm wondering, has there been any kind of research like this done anywhere else in Eastern Europe or Eastern Germany?
There's been a lot of poll, not looking at whether or not people can change. I haven't seen anything on this kind of good work types of argument. Mm-hmm. You do see, you know, questions about support for privatization cross-nationally, you know, which you might be able to pull something out of that. Cross-nationally, the, you know, support for state property is much higher in Russia than it is, say, in Eastern Europe. That's one of the results from those cross-national. Now, another tricky thing is why this might not travel is that, you know, the privatization in the post-communist world was like lots of privatizations other places where they were politically motivated and corrupt and all these other kinds of things. But they were also different in just the sheer scope and scale and rapidity of these privatizations. When we talk about privatization in Latin America, we're often talking about, you know, privatizing a specific, you know, utility or a specific telephone company. And people, you know a lot about it. And it's not this kind of avalanche, you know, privatization that happened in a lot of these countries in the region. So.
Two comments, I guess, maybe we can respond, not necessarily though. So first of all, I think you're using legitimacy, or you define legitimacy in terms of legality, it seems. And in a way, it's a shame you didn't ask, despite your Russian colleague's skepticism, about
no violations at all.
Because I suspect, especially given these high levels, that what you're picking up lies that some people think all privatization is illegitimate, and there's no such thing as a legally.
Yeah, I mean, that state property being
right.
you know that high,
right.
if you equate legitimacy and effectiveness, yeah, you might.
Right, so just analytically, you might want to try to keep those distinct when you're writing it up.
Yeah.
And the second point is that if you think of the larger implications of this, they're kind of interesting. That actually, let's say that there were no concerns about legitimacy, then, in fact, you would probably have less investment in public goods and less. Actually, the perceived illegitimacy of privatization itself provides, and plus your findings that they can marginally reduce their illegitimacy by providing public goods and by using the assets. Well, actually, if you draw that out, it suggests that actually Russia's better off to the extent that there's at least a fair amount of legitimacy out there. I don't know, you play around with some threshold beyond which there's no longer.
That's a great. That's a good point. And I mean, on the one hand, it's good that they're providing public goods, right? You know, not a lot of them, you know, being provided, but maybe more now than in the past. Now the state's got some money. There's also a deeper question, though, of, you know, do we want firms to be doing this, right? We think that we really want states to be providing the public goods for lots of well-known reasons, and to have the firms concentrate on, you know, what, you know, so they're supposedly good at. The other, I think, point to mention is that the over time variation of you can steal it at T1, but you have to pay for it at T2 by providing public goods or being squeezed by the new guy who comes along who wasn't in the government that made this corrupt privatization deal. You know, all of a sudden he's got a lot of leverage because, you know, his hands are, you know, supposedly clean for not having been involved in this, and it's easy for him to rally, you know, mass support against against these guys. So the other thing to think about is, you know, is this though socially less costly to have firms provide public goods and become good citizens than, you know, renationalizing or reprivatizing, right? I mean, one way, you know, I mean, how did property rights in the U.S. become legitimate, right? I mean, some people, you know, I don't know who said it, but there's a quote that, you know, property rights in the U.S. became accepted through a collective act of national amnesia or something, you know, that, you know, you had these robber barons, they stole his assets, and over time, you know, Carnegie Foundation, Ford Foundation, all these other agencies that we all, you know and love. You know, so our hands are guilty too. Dave?
In your earlier work, you argued that the distribution of ownership, the diffusion of shares,
right,
would add to credibility. But is the situation now that those...
Yeah, those results might have been time-bound, right? Yeah, I did a paper in a volume that Dave edited where looked at the price of the privatization voucher, and the question was, as more vouchers got distributed into the public, did the voucher then become less susceptible to political shocks? And the results were minor shocks, yes, major shocks, not so much. But now I think that, you know, people are beyond, don't seem to have benefited dramatically from holding on to the shares.
The shares did not stay dispersed.
They did not. They ended up being worth much less. I mean, the bigger problem is that they were just worth much less than people thought. And it might have been in part because the way privatization, you know, was done. There are all these quotes. Berezovsky has a quote where he said, "Oh yeah, it was easy to privatize things. You could go and, you know, privatize things for a dollar because the communists and the local governments were glad to give this stuff away because they knew or they expected that they could take it back anytime they wanted." This is, you know, to believe Berezovsky is a fool's errand. But, you know, I mean, this is the way to think about it. Yeah?
I have a survey design question. Could you go back to the questions on inequality and public ownership?
Yeah.
Because my recollections are one-sided questions that...
we asked.
So it's basically, you know.
There.
Okay, so it's very strongly one-sided, and agree or disagree. And then on the, you know, do you prefer public ownership? Same thing. It was one-sided, agree, disagree.
Right.
And a lot of survey research shows that there's an agree bias, basically.
Right.
People,
right,
especially when it's strongly worded like this, I mean, as much as 15-20%.
Right, so maybe the levels are higher.
So, you know, so the two-sided question would be, you know, some people say state ownership is more effective, others say private is. Your percent agreeing would go way down. Two-sided.
But would the levels be... it's hard. Is there a bias within the levels as well, or bias within...
But the good news is, I think it works to your advantage in terms of the bias, the direction of the bias, because what you're going to have is a false overstatement of agreeing that public ownership is better, and you're finding a relationship there still in your probe analysis.
Right.
So I think if you had a two-sided question, the results would be stronger here.
Right.
But on inequality, maybe explain why you're not showing any results on inequality. If you had a two-sided question,
you might
actually be showing
The other thing is we have single items too, which, you know, we if we had more money, we'd like to have a whole battery of questions about inequality and about property.
But you don't need another question. Just a two-sided.
Question. I mean, in addition to the two-sided question, it probably would be better to have more. We also asked some questions more directly about, which The rich in Russia are wealthy because of their ability. Strongly agree, more or less disagree, strongly disagree. So about 27-28% say they agree with that. It's because of their ability. Most people disagree. Then the rich and wealthy, the rich in Russia are wealthy because they use corruption and bribes. Right? Strongly agree, more or less disagree. Strongly disagree. And then we also asked, Russians are great believers in sudba, luck, so fortuna, fate. The rich in Russia are wealthy because of luck. We get roughly half the response there. And this was again, I think in retrospect, this might just be, to put this into the equation would be, putting the same idea on both sides. So in some ways, the question that we asked on inequality, is a very general question about whether it's, unavoidable and unavoidable and justified. In part, that was done to try to, to try to defame the response, because it was in a set of questions about privatization.
Right, and see what it does, though, it biases the result in the direction of more people saying that inequality is acceptable. Because right. If you had the true response, it didn't have the pre-bias built in, you'd have a much lower level of acceptance of inequality.
Right.
Really, I mean, so I think
I worry as much about such a general question like that's really, tapping is probably also, it's hard to, these are not easy things, but
for those who are thinking about doing something like this, can you talk about, was it hard to explain to people at Levada what you wanted to do?
On the experiments, the two people that I was working with, they picked it up immediately. Like when I explained them what I wanted to do, they said, okay, yeah, I got it. The most difficult part is, I do the randomizations here and generate, 1,600 different versions of that portion of the survey. And the difficult thing is the formatting to get, those questions in that small a space and still have them be, legible for the people to go out and actually do them. And I type in Russian, at a snail's pace. So it's really, and these kind of, the things they don't teach you in methodology 101 about, actually doing field research really took an awful lot of time. Everything had to be on 4 pages, and if it went over a little bit, then the whole thing had to be redone. The cost was not too big. It was about $550 a question to add on to the survey. So, and they give you the kind of 10 basic demographic points. So, it's not for a graduate student who wants to do add questions onto this survey. It's not a impossible thing to do. And they're pretty good, I think, Levada Center. I think they're pretty competent. One thing, when I was there designing one of the other surveys I did, they're constantly getting calls from these poor people in the region about how their interviews were going. So they were doing something out there in the region. So hopefully they were actually going to the doors they're supposed to be going to. If anybody's any comments, questions, this is all really good, because it would be good to think about this again or in another setting, an equally corrupt, privatization, but maybe one with a different kind of government. You might have different kinds of responses, or do an Eastern Europe, something like that might be interesting as well.
Try Turkmenistan or
I don't advise trying to do it in the. I think it's the kind of thing that might be interesting to do elsewhere. So, and please feel free to send comments, questions, or concerns. So.
So I guess I'm supposed to say...
Is that no, I'm just wondering. I don't know. What do they say? You know, you just stand up and say, thank you, you've been a wonderful audience. When you're done.